Welcome to The Technology Pill, a podcast that looks at how technology is reshaping our lives every day and exploring the different ways that governments and companies use tech to increase their power. Welcome back to all of our listeners, and I have to say, I'm sorry for all the background noise. We're recording this on a Monday morning in London, where we normally expect Monday mornings to be very, very slow and quiet around the office. But everybody's in, very excited. It's the first warm day in quite a while, and so there's a lot of chatter and a lot of actually beautiful noise that we didn't have for such a long time. So I'm very grateful for that. And I'm very grateful to be joined by my very good colleague, Jonah Mendelson, who is working on our migration project. And I was wondering if you could just quickly, Jonah, give us a picture of what we're about to talk about.
So today we're going to be joined by a lawyer, Katie Schwartzman, and her client, Mark Nelson, to talk about a challenge that they've brought against the government's use of GPS tracking as a condition of immigration bail. Now, GPS tracking is being used by the Home Office to track the location of migrants.
And just to put this in the picture, we're talking about the United Kingdom, where, as listeners will know, whenever I start talking about the United Kingdom, you kind of hope I don't end up talking about the Home Office because it gets me sweary. The Home Office is essentially the Interior Ministry of the United Kingdom. And so it's responsible for policing, it's responsible for migration, and so it's doing all the surveillance all the time in the United Kingdom. Sorry, go on, John.
And as with the criminal justice system, these electronic monitoring conditions and trackers are usually imposed via ankle tags attached to the ankle of the person being tracked. But more recently, the Home Office has also been rolling out so-called non-fitted devices, which a person needs to carry around at all times, which also track them, also collect their data, including their fingerprint data that they have to scan at frequent occasions on the day. And these conditions are being imposed on migrants on what's called immigration bail. And that's a regime of several different conditions that are imposed on individuals who don't have immigration status in the country, so who don't currently have the right to reside, the right to legally live here under immigration laws. And in particular, they're being imposed on people subject to deportation orders. But also the Home Office has been using these conditions on small boat arrivals. So that's channel crossings, dangerous channel crossings of migrants between France and the UK. The last few years have seen the expansion of this type of surveillance from just a few hundred cases before 2020 to now over 4,000 cases that have just been imposed in this year alone.
So let's hear the story of Mark. We're very grateful that Mark and Katie are joining us today. And let's move to that part of this podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. I was wondering if we could first introduce ourselves, starting with you, Katie.
Hi, I'm Katie Schwartzman. I'm a solicitor in public law and human rights at Wilson Solicitors, and I've been representing Mark in his GPS tag challenge. And I'm also a research fellow researching automated decision making in immigration systems.
Cool. And how about you, Mark?
I am Mark Nelson, a client of Katie Schwartzman, pertaining the tagging of the Home Office.
Thank you for joining us and for talking about what is a very complicated issue, which is the idea of GPS tracking of humans. Mark, why don't you explain to us, what does GPS tracking look like? I think people understand the idea that there's a global positioning system, that these satellites are hovering above the Earth, and we have devices that contact them. But what do these devices look and feel like to a human being who has to wear one?
Basically, you're in an open prison, big open prison with people monitoring you 24/7.
You couldn't put it any more clearly. Okay. What does it look like at a technical level? What is it for you? Like, it's something you have to wear.
How does it feel on you? I mean, is it, it's quite a heavy thing, isn't it?
It's basically this device that they strap to your leg, and it's really uncomfortable. It's annoying. Really and truly, the way I put it is that it's inhumane.
And so why have they imposed it on you?
Basically, they think that I might abscond, hence the reason why they're putting a tag on me.
And how long have you had to wear it for?
About 18 months now.
Oh my gosh.
Which is one of the huge things with this, that there's no time limit. It potentially could just be indefinite. There's nothing in law and in policy which says, you know, this is the exact amount of time it will have to be, and then it has to be taken off.
I mean, we've been trying to get it off ever since it's been on. So yeah, that's 20 months.
20 months. Katie, can you give us some legal context as to how this came about and what's going on at the moment?
Yeah, so anyone in the UK who is subject to either deportation proceedings or a deportation order may be subject to immigration bail. And immigration bail is a set of conditions to ensure the Home Office can keep tabs on you, essentially. And that can come in the way of less intrusive means, sort of reporting once a week, which Mark also does, to the Home Office, or a curfew, which Mark doesn't have, or residence conditions, you have to live at a certain property, which Mark does have, and also an electronic monitoring condition, which usually takes the form nowadays of a GPS tagging device. And that can be fitted or non-fitted, so something fitted to your ankle, which you have to wear all the time, or something non-fitted, sort of a fingerprint scanner, for example. But Mark's is fitted to his ankle and he's had to wear that for 20 months. And as Jonah said, it's indefinite. Technically, it's until you're either granted leave to remain or deported. But as everyone knows, there's a huge asylum and immigration backlog, and that can take many, many years.
Yeah, basically, the tagging is on you until they give you leave to remain. But I mean, I was granted leave to remain in 2007. So basically, what they're doing now, they revoked my indefinite leave to remain and now put me in a position where I've got to wear a tag and I'm liable for deportation. Yeah. So it's not even the fact that you've lived here for how many years, have paid your taxes, you've been a good citizen up until, I mean, you've got into your trouble or whatever. Now it's just this inhumane behavior from the Home Office.
And on the physical device itself, I'm right in saying that you have to charge it for, you know, really long periods of time. And often, you know, what the Home Office says about how long you actually have to be charging it isn't always reflective of reality.
No, I mean, when they just put this tag on, I was charging it for like 6 hours. Then they had to come and change it. When they came and change it, it wasn't working. You know, I just think there's somebody somewhere making a lot of money from this at the moment.
Yeah, and just to dig deeper on this, like, I feel horrible asking these questions, but I'm trying to understand what it's like to have this attached to your leg. What is your daily life like as a result of this?
I've got to charge it up, plug it via a lead, you know, like your mobile phone, plug that in, plug it into the tagging device. Then if I'm going out and I think that the charge that's in it might not last until I get back home, I also have to carry a travel charger, which if I put the travel charger on it, I'm walking around with a bulky, heavy device on my leg. No one can miss that. So I've got to make sure I'm not in public with that, you know, because I don't want people seeing this tag on my leg. They get the wrong idea, you know. So if I'm out, I'm always conscious of, you know, making sure it's covered up.
Just going to say, I remember calling you when it was 40 degrees, that heat wave, and you were wearing tracksuit bottoms in the park because you obviously don't want people seeing it. And it, so it completely changes what you can wear and where you go. And remember you saying picking up your kids at the schoolyard, you don't want people seeing it. So that affects your kind of movements. And charging it, I remember you telling me how, because it takes so long to charge, you'd go to bed with the travel charger on and then it vibrates when it's ready. So at 4 a.m. it vibrates you up.
Or if I go to bed without it charged, then it starts vibrating and wakes me up. It's no fun.
To add to all of it, the anxiety around it, because if you don't have it charged, you're in fear of reaching your bail conditions, which could mean you get detained, it could impact your deportation proceedings.
It's an offence as well, isn't it? So it could be, as you say, so many different consequences, and it might be something completely that isn't your fault at all, because as I understand it, the amount of charging time is supposed to be 2 hours a day, you know, and if you're having to do 6 hours a day, it's almost like you're, as you described it, it's imprisonment, because to properly charge it, you need to be spending all these hours at home or running back when the device is beeping to say it's low battery.
Yep.
Your whole description to date is textbook inhumanity. But on top of that, what I find fascinating is that you are somehow delegated the responsibility of your own incarceration. And you're delegated the responsibility of recording your incarceration. And you can't risk not recording your incarceration, and you can't risk the data that's being accumulated on you. You can't risk it being inaccurate because of whatever you do, but there's still that risk that it's going to be inaccurate because of the faulty technology as well.
Hmm. And Katie and Mark, maybe you guys can talk a bit about the very real inaccuracies in Mark's case, with lots of the locational data just being plain wrong.
Yeah, I mean, they've sent us back some data which is totally inaccurate. I mean, I've pulled up now, I'm sat in the car, and I'm sure it's got me in some address that I'm not even at. And that's how it is.
It's telling a story of your life that might not actually be your story.
Yeah.
It's got me walking it on train tracks in the middle of the night.
Yeah, so we spent a really long time as part of this case fighting to get disclosure of the trail data, which is the data of all his GPS coordinates, so longitudinal and latitudinal coordinates, because it should be collecting them according to the policy 24/7 wherever Mark goes, because the whole idea is that if he abscond, you can find him. But when we got this trail data, we went through it quite extensively with Mark and found him to be in the middle of rivers, at the middle of night, in cemeteries at very early hours of the morning, just completely ridiculous places and places that he'd never been to. And to date, we haven't really got a response about that. So the technology itself, the whole purpose of it, doesn't seem to be working. So in my mind, it's more a sort of form of performative cruelty to show that it looks like the government are doing something, but the actual technical aspects and the finer details aren't being monitored particularly. And the Home Office haven't seemed to be worried when we've brought up these concerns.
But also the Home Office reserves the right to be accessing the locational data, what you call the trail data, and using it for all kinds of purposes. So, for example, it reserves the right to use it in immigration proceedings, you know, to make findings about somebody's immigration case. And if this is putting you in locations where you aren't even at, that could really lead to life-changing, catastrophic consequences. You know, say you're actually picking up your kids, but it shows you in the middle of the river. I mean, it could really impact your case in that sense.
Yeah, and I mean, if they're going to try and use that data in another case, then it's inaccurate.
But Mark, I mean, maybe you can shed some light on it. Surely it will be quite difficult to then prove something like that wrong. Nobody keeps the tab of where they were, like, you know, 6 months ago, do they really? I mean,
no, because if they were to ask me where I was a few weeks ago, I probably wouldn't remember. You know, I'm not keeping track of my own self, you know, but it's no fun. It's what they're doing is just inhumane, and they know it's wrong. It's a form of intimidation and bully. You know, look, we know the system is wrong all over. I mean, to me, I could say it's systematically racism. Well, that's how I look at it anyway. They know that certain people wouldn't end up in this situation. So anybody else who is in this situation definitely isn't English or maybe wasn't born here. So yeah, they just start targeting who they call immigrants. And because I didn't spend that money and buy a British passport when I had my indefinite, hence me being in this situation.
So we're an international organization. We work across the world. But a policy like this is groundbreaking, and for all the horrible reasons. And so often the Home Office internationally is breaking grounds, particularly when they play with toys like technologies that force people to do things. And what we're seeing is Australia is now toying with the deployment of the exact same type of practice. In America, the Biden administration is either talking about it or have started deploying it.
They're already using it in very, very similar ways to the Home Office. Yeah.
And so before other countries follow suit, what would you have us tell them as an international organization?
Like I said, it's blatantly racism. You know, you mention it, Australia, America, and it's a certain set of people that are in charge of these countries. And they know mainly who they're targeting with these kind of rhetoric, you know. And I mean, Australia of all countries, Australia and America, you know, all of Australia is immigrants. They were moved there, you know. The people from Australia are not implying these rhetoric system or whatever they're trying to impose, you know. I mean, the natives are not doing it. These are all done by immigrants of a different race.
Yeah. And one of the really sinister things I think I've come across is how the rhetoric around it in Australia and other places is saying that this is a humane alternative to detention. You know, that it's 100% accurate and it's actually just much better than detaining people. But I think Mark's case really just exposes how that is such a flawed idea. And especially the multiple issues. You know, we've talked a bit about the inaccurate nature of some of the data. One of the other actually really striking things, and maybe you guys can shed some light on it now, is how the device just wasn't working for long periods of time.
What was it, about 6 months it didn't work?
6 months?
Just nothing.
Yeah,
we had to be chasing them, weren't we, Katie?
Yeah, so Mark called me saying, I don't think my tag's working, it's not looking right. And I've had a call from a field officer from the Home Office saying it's not picking up DPS signals. So Mark spoke to his reporting officer the next day to report it. I sent a very long letter to the Home Office saying, look, it's not working, can you fix it or can you take it off? They refused to really engage, and it's the subject of dispute for a long time. And then we got to the hearing and we thought we were going to have to argue about it, but on the first day the Home Office conceded for the purposes of the case alone, not conceded in general, which is a specific legal sort of strategy, but for the purpose of the case alone, that the tag had not worked properly for a period of 6 months. It was more specific language exactly, but essentially that they were willing to accept that for the purposes of our case to be decided. And that's only because we had been, you know, banging the drum for over a year saying it didn't work, and you now know it doesn't work. So have you taken that into account for the fact that you don't need to keep tabs on Mark every day? Because he knew it didn't work, you knew it didn't work for 6 months, and he was still reporting every week, he was still complying with his bail, still being a good citizen, but it didn't seem to matter. And my understanding of what the Home Office's response was it still fits the purpose of immigration control, it's still within the law to tag someone with a tag that doesn't work. The judge described it as a shackle,
an ugly bracelet even.
You know, that doesn't mean that the judge agreed with our position, but we are waiting, obviously judgment's still outstanding, we're waiting for it to be decided. But it was a pretty, I mean, I'm just the lawyer, but for Mark, I'll let him speak to it, it was a pretty frustrating and difficult time because we were trying so hard and Mark was doing everything right. And at one point, the Home Office tried to blame him for not charging it properly. And we said, but why would Mark be reporting it? His intention was not to be complying. It's because he's wanting to comply so properly with all his conditions to not have any trouble.
The common statement we hear from people who are unaffected is that, look, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. And here you are actually not hiding. You're actively doing your bit. And this is what power does. It makes you perform even if it's failing. Mm. You know, this is outrageous. Mm. And I wonder how many other people are in this exact situation. I'm sorry, Mark, I'm not letting you speak, please.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of people on it. I know people, the way they manage to get it off is by being crazy. Mm. Actually walk into a mental hospital and sign themselves in. Because the tag has been so much of a mental issue for them, they had to go into a mental hospital.
How has it just all of this really been impacting your mental health? Because I, you know, obviously it takes time to actually get all of this data. And I think that's an important point to make. And all this while, you know, something's not working, but you're not actually sure how much it's tracking you or exactly what's happening. How has that affected you?
Like I said, it's just having the tag on alone. It makes you feel like you're in prison mentally. So that alone, in a sense, is if you don't try and keep yourself strong, which is hard, you'll basically lose it. Because you're wondering every day, why? Why am I wearing this? Why? Every day. You know, it's impacting on how you go out with your kids. You want to make sure at all time when you're in public that this tag is covered over, because you don't want to expose it. So mentally, it's always there. It's always on your mind, this tag. It never leaves. You should have to be thinking about that.
I was just going to add, Mark, how, you know, in being detained in immigration detention, you didn't have mental health symptoms. It all started, you know, the pressure and the upset and a real deterioration started in May 2022 when you were tagged. And the first 6 months of taking on Mark, you know, we couldn't really talk about it without it being a very, very distressing call.
Very emotional. Yeah.
Maybe you guys could explain a bit about the actual case and how that's gone over the last months. That would be really interesting to hear.
So, as we mentioned, Mark was tagged in May 2022, and I was also instructed to represent him that same month, very quickly after. And it was a challenge because this is, you know, the policy was new. There's no cases in the courts that have discussed this before. So completely new terrain, very little regulation. The Home Office is sort of policing itself. There's really kind of a bit of a Wild West. So we wrote to the Home Office before we tried to take it to court saying, look, it's really affecting Mark's mental health, his family life, to the extent that it's breaching his right to a family and private life under the Human Rights Act. And we're also worried about the accuracy of the data and arguments to that effect. We really, really tried very hard to not have to resort to court proceedings because we really believe and still believe that Mark can be monitored for immigration enforcement purposes with much less intrusive methods, and that under the right to a private and family life, it's a balancing act, and it's about how proportionate the measure is, so GPS tagging for the purpose of immigration enforcement, is against how much it impacts his private and family life. And we thought that balance was completely wrong. There was no reason, there was no need for it. We tried very hard. We put in medical evidence. We put in a lot of evidence, a lot of independent state bodies saying how great Mark is and how compliant and how much he wants to be, you know, a good citizen and to just live his life. However, the Home Office didn't back down, and we had to issue proceedings in November 2022. There was a lot of delays in the case because several times the Home Office didn't put in their pleadings. We were supposed to go to final hearing, but the Home Office hadn't put in their defence, so we had to adjourn the case. Even that was despite the fact that we had been granted expedition on the basis that the Home Office had already delayed the case so far. So we didn't actually get a final hearing until November 2023. We had tried to settle throughout, but the Home Office didn't want to settle, and we are currently awaiting judgment. So it's been a really, really long process, and it was the first case in the UK to be heard on this issue. And so it was in the Upper Tribunal Immigration and Asylum Chamber, which was with judges exercising their High Court jurisdiction, which is a legal way of saying that whatever decision they make will bind lower courts. It could get appealed, depending on the decision, to the Court of Appeal and then the Supreme Court and then even to the European Court of Human Rights. But that's all to be determined on what the decision is and what the parties want to do, what Mark wants to do. So we're hoping we'll hear soon, but you know, it's already been 2 months of the judgment and Mark's still wearing the tag. So I really hope we hear soon.
As listeners of this podcast know, at PI, we take on the UK government with frequency. And the one part of the UK government we find most frustrating is the Home Office. And so This is the Interior Ministry, the Justice Department, as it is in other countries. And the fact that they don't show up to court prepared, there's maliciousness and there's incompetency. And when the two come together, for me, that describes the Home Office. And it sounds like your case. This is unbelievable. Lawyers not showing up ready, you know, like this, that's unforgivable.
To clarify, they didn't not show up ready. They just didn't do their defense. And then we had to adjourn the hearing because the hearing was only a few days later. So in effect, but we were emailing at sort of midnight to the court and to the judges, working out what was going to happen with the hearing in a few days time. And it was extremely stressful. And obviously more so for Mark, having no idea if his final hearing was happening that week or not.
And having to travel from Leeds to London for the hearing as well.
And not being able to kind of prepare for that in a longer term way, which is how you'd want to be. In terms of their kind of arguments and how they approach the case, and that's something I think we'd be really interested to hear about as well. The Home Office were barely obstructive and also just not very forthcoming as well, right?
Yeah, it's just been quite a fight. We wanted to settle. We didn't want to go to court. There's no reason we would want to, but we had no choice. And we requested disclosure and trail data. That was a fight. We requested disclosure of discussions about Mark's tag. And again, we hadn't received that by the date the final hearing was supposed to be the first time. So another reason we had to adjourn the hearing. It wasn't until the court that they conceded that the tag hadn't worked for 6 months, despite us saying for about a year that we didn't think the tag was working. It was only because we'd really forced their hand and got evidence to prove it, and we were in a court case, that we were able to skip arguing over it because the Home Office realised they had to concede it for the purposes of the case. Mark might want to speak about this more, because I know that I'm the one calling him saying, I know it's 10 a.m. and you might be coming to London today for your hearing, but just wait to hear from me if that's going to happen. And calling him saying, I'm going to urgently need to speak to you in the next half an hour because this is all uncertain and we don't know this. We've heard how all-consuming the tagging is on Mark and how horrendous it is and the impact on his mental health, and not the feeling that the Home Office is taking this case sufficiently seriously given the really significant effect on a person who lives in the UK's life.
And I think for me, it just sums it all up when they're coming into court saying somebody can still be tagged, it's still right to tag them if the device isn't working for 6 months. They're complying with all of their conditions, but it's still fine to have this, in effect, a chain on them that has no purpose, and that still should still be lawful.
Yep, you've said it there. They knew a long, long time that a tag wasn't working, that the system is wrong, and they still insist on me wearing this tag. I mean, they've basically came into court and said that I ain't got no choice but to wear this tag, even though it's inaccurate.
And Mark, I mean, what is it like to have to report, to have to do all of these other things?
Every Thursday, I've got to make sure that there's an hour between 10 and 12 to go and report to them. You know, everywhere, even coming to court in London, I had to make arrangements around me going to report to them. So, I mean, every Thursday, every week, it's definitely going to have some impact on your life and your well-being and your mental health, because you're just going to see these people for 2 minutes. And the biggest fear of it all is that you might not come back out of that office.
You mean that they could detain you while you were at the premises?
They could detain you there and there without no warning. So I'm always trying to prepare myself for that. I try to ring Kirsty every Thursday and go, yeah, I'm going to go see these people now. I'll ring you when I'm getting out. So I've got to adjust myself, my mental self, to deal with all of these. I mean, if I didn't have this fight with them and have all the confidence in the team that's working with me, I probably would have lost it long time ago. Like you say, it's only recently I can kind of hold myself together and speak about the situation. It's not easy, because mentally it's having its toll.
Mark, I'm so sorry.
Another kind of part of the story, as I understand it, is that the Home Office has been using a AI tool, an automated decision-making tool, as part of its GPS tracking decision-making. And that tool may have been used in your case. Are you guys able to kind of explain a bit about what the tool is and how you think it's being used?
So the policy doesn't give very much information, but it does tell us that an automated business tool is being used. I'm not entirely clear of how it works because there is so little in the public domain about it. And automated decision making basically means some sort of algorithm to make decisions. And we understand that it's being used to decide in what's called de-escalation decisions. So a decision to move someone like Mark from a fitted device to a non-fitted device, so from an ankle monitor to a fingerprint scanner, and then again to de-escalate from a fingerprint device to nothing. I understand that Public Law Project have recently done some research which found in a period from 22nd of May 2023 to 14th of August 2023 that the Home Office only decided to cease electronic monitoring conditions of 1% of cases. So we don't know entirely how this algorithm's working, what the inputs are. We know that it sort of generates a harm score of some type. We don't know what the inputs are. Could that be nationality? Could there be inputs that might be proxies for quite racist or other discriminatory inputs? We don't know if it's predictive or if it has some sort of technology that means that there's feedback loops, which means that, you know, the more negative decisions it makes, it learns to make even more. We just have no idea. There's been plenty of Freedom of Information Act requests made by civil society to learn more, and there's been very little information about it. And we discussed this in court, but judgments are awaited on how that will go and if it will be a feature of the judgment. But I think all claims regarding electronic monitoring should definitely be asking questions about how this algorithm is being used, because you can only challenge a decision if you understand the decision. If we don't understand it, the power imbalance is even greater than we already started with.
Katie, can I just nerd out at a legal level with you for a second, which is, how do you raise a thing like this in court? How does a judge engage with these types of questions?
Well, it sort of depends how much information you have to start with. If we knew for certain that Mark had been subject to this artificial intelligence rule, that would sort of change the way we would approach it, because we would be able to ask more conclusively for the information about the algorithm. We might not get it. If you don't know, which we don't 100% know, we haven't been given enough information in our opinion. So we asked the court to draw adverse inferences. So in the type of proceeding we brought, the public body, so the Home Office, is under what's known as a duty of candor. So a duty to be frank and transparent and disclose anything relevant to Mark's case. We have argued that we think that they have breached this duty, and we've asked the court to draw an adverse inference. So draw inferences that it has been used and the Home Office has not been candid with us. You know, that would give us some information, but it is obviously not going to tell us too much about the algorithm still. But it all remains to be determined how it will be approached, if at all, by the judges.
Just for context, in Freedom of Information responses, the Home Office has actually publicly said, you know, we're using this in all review cases. So to then try to say we're not using it when you're on the record saying you are using it is contradictory, to say the least. And it raises real issues of transparency and just being obstructive, which goes to what you've been describing in about how the litigation has gone.
And do you know if there's actually any real human review somewhere along this chain?
My understanding, and I am saying this from memory, not from reading anything, so I'm not going to be 100% right, but I think it's always going to have a human review. I don't think it's solely automated decision making, and that is, but obvious, if you're a legal nerd like me, reasons that the relevant data protection legislation only really bites when there's a decision that's solely made by algorithms. So if there is a human in the loop or a human deciding the ultimate decision on the basis of the algorithm, then it's obviously a bit more complicated, but it might avoid really having the force of the law against it.
But one of the problems, and I think it's common to a lot of these type of systems, is that people, you know, they won't have necessarily the right training on how to use the tool. And if the tool just gives a harm score, you know, that recommends that somebody, you know, stays on a tag or is moved to a different type of device, the scope for them to actually really engage with that and consider all of the facts, all of the circumstances, and make their own decision may in fact be limited. And that really goes to automation bias, which is the principle of public bodies potentially just making decisions based on what the algorithm tells them to, that don't take into account a real human review.
Yeah, and the Home Office casework isn't sort of any public body caseworker, but in particular the Home Office, we know that there is huge backlog in the system. We know that they're under-resourced, overworked. They have targets of how many cases to review in a day. To have really the time and space to critically analyze the outcomes of algorithms, given that the caseworker themselves, as you say, we don't know their training, we don't know if they understand the algorithm, or even if it's possible to, if it's a self-learning algorithm, is really going to depart from its judgment. We just don't know. And, you know, if you're junior, or even if you're not junior, you might, as you say, have an automation bias where you don't think, how could I know better than an algorithm? An algorithm is this objective, correct, you know, machine, computer. Why would I know any better? And so there isn't much regulation currently on how much training there needs to be, on how much transparency. There isn't currently a watchdog or any sort of independent commissioner that checks algorithms before they're rolled out by the Home Office or other public bodies. There's really no, very little to no oversight. And essentially, it means it can be experimented, and there's a huge generation of these sorts of new algorithms and new types of systems in the Home Office in their new strategy, which is to become digital by design, which means that...
Whatever that means. It's for them.
We know what it means.
So, you know, there's lots of positives out of technology, but it does need to be, in my opinion, regulated so it's done fairly and for the best outcomes for people and the real humans at the end of it, like Mark. And so, yeah, at the moment, the Home Office is essentially experimenting with people, and people where there's a huge power imbalance. And even where there's lawyers trying to find out about it, we're struggling to find out more.
I think, just to draw this to a close, I think for people who have to navigate, like our listeners do, navigate the world of technology, and a lot of the people listening are the kind of people who build technologies, they're imagining that technologies will bring a better future. They imagine in the future, we'll have flying cars, we'll have AIs that serve you very well. And Katie, what you just described and what Mark's lived reality is, I fear that's the future. It's not that AIs will exist everywhere and it'll be a perfectly run society. No, governments will not give up their powers. And I'm not speaking on your case, because it's for you to speak for yourselves. But in our experience, a Home Office does always mix maliciousness with incompetency, and AI is not going to fix that. A new digital strategy is not going to fix that. This is what they do, and this is what governments do repeatedly. And that's the future we're building. And that's why I love the work that you're both doing, Mark, for your freedom, and Katie, for just getting justice in a situation like this, because anybody's future that involves interfacing with the state will have to navigate these exact issues, which is, are you generating the right data for the state? Is the state actually using that data fairly? And when they come after you, it'll be up to you to defend yourself. And with this huge power imbalance you described, Katie. So Mark, if I could just ask to close this off, if you could imagine a better future right now for you and your case, what would it be? Where does this come to a good ending?
A good ending would be with me getting back my indefinite leave to remain and me able to build a future for my kids and my family and myself. Also, I want to touch on, you know, where the Home Office is heading with this algorithm. I mean, now it's just immigrants, people who are subject to deportation and who are claiming asylum or whatever, wearing this tagging. Now it's us, but I can see the government rolling it out to the wider public in the future. You know, so we need to be careful as people what we're letting these government do with our data, all of this algorithm, because they're using it for a lot of other stuff at the moment, and slowly feeding it to the public, and it's going to become wide scale in the future. And I'd like to see that stop, basically, because it's not going to be no good for society. You know, it's just going to be certain people who benefits from all that data.
Mark, in that regard, you're a trailblazer for being a victim of this system, but you're a trailblazer for fighting it. And we really, really appreciate what you're doing for everybody. And we wish you all the best. And we're going to follow your case very closely. Thank you for joining us. We really appreciate this.
Thanks for having me as well.
Okay, just to close off then, Jonah, I was wondering if you could just explain what we at PR are actually doing about all of this, because this is a gross injustice using technology and using data. This is our bread and butter in many ways. What are we doing?
I mean, GPS tracking is something that we've been looking at as an issue for quite a few years. Part of that has taken the form of doing a lot of research around the technology itself. So we've actually purchased ankle trackers and tested them on our own staff members to see the accuracy of the data.
They volunteered for it to be tested. This is not a common
All done above board. But this was designed to show, you know, how intrusive this is, what kind of data it collects, and how accurate or often inaccurate the data is. And this kind of research has also fed into complaints before regulators. So one complaint that has gone into the Information Commissioner's Office, which is the UK Data Protection Authority, is all about how we say this type of monitoring breaches data privacy and data protection principles. You know, it's happening in a way that is not transparent, in a way that doesn't have enough of a lawful basis, or it's just being done without enough limits on it. And then secondly, we've also had a separate complaint before what's called the Forensic Science Regulator, and that's all about the quality of the devices themselves. And finally, we've been supporting other cases and litigation. So in the claim today, we've been supporting that case through witness evidence that summarizes all of our tech research and our other work around this.
Thank you for that. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember, you can tell us what you think about the podcast by visiting us at pvcy.org/tpsurvey. And you could be the first to learn about new developments by signing up to our mailing list around our podcast at pvcy.org/podsignup. And we'll include some links to relevant articles and information about the case and about GPS tags and other aspects of our work on immigration and related issues in the description, wherever you're listening, or on our website at pvcy.org/techpill. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you use. Music courtesy of Sepia. This podcast was produced by Max Burnell for Privacy International.